Well, I'm Sheldon Brown, host of Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. And Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us is brought to you by Framework, or Framework Trust, in fact. Now, Framework has its big touch tournament tomorrow. We had to postpone that from last Wednesday, and we're just hoping that the weather is going to be kind to us, despite the fact that the forecast this afternoon is for thunderstorms. But anyway, that touch tournament is at Cox's Bay. It kicks off about 10, so we need all the teams there well before. The other great news and big news from Framework is that there are discussions occurring between Framework and Connect Supporting Recovery towards a merger. These discussions are very premature at the moment, but that's exciting news for the mental health sector. So we have technician Declan Curran with us on Mental Health Radio, and we've got a bit of a challenge today because we've got a pre-record from Mad in America, a podcast, and Declan is going to try and break into that. It's a 46-minute interview, and it raises the issue of the pressure we feel to be happy. When I promoted this broadcast on social media, I got a message via Facebook which said, "My hubby and I were just talking about this very same thing, pressure to be happy, just now over lunch. So true, and there are those around who are waking up to the corporate and government interests." Those corporate and government interests are the ones, they believe, that are putting the pressure on us to be happy. So this review about the pressure to be happy is brought to you in a podcast from Mad in America Radio. It's an interview with a Will Davies, who's a reader in political economy at Goldsmiths University of London and author of a book called The Happiness Industry. This interview discusses the increasing pressure people face to be happy and think positive, and how this pressure serves corporate and government interests. But just before we listen, here's a quote from Jimmy Hunt, who describes himself as a mental health change maker, and he asks this very crucial question: how often do you do nothing? And I really mean nothing. No phone, no music, no other people, no laptop, no anything. How often? Probably not very much, right? asked Jimmy. One of the most important things we can ever do is to do nothing. The concentrated version of doing nothing is called meditation, but the unconcentrated version is important too. Our brain needs time to breathe. What a wonderful little phrase that is. Our brain needs time to breathe, because we are constantly bombarding it with stimulus. It does not have the time to relax, to heal, and then to create and imagine. So Jimmy suggests, find some time to take some time. Your mind will thank you for it. So here's the Mad in America podcast. We've got it there, every Declan.
I think I'm ready to roll. I was just going to say my brain needs a bit of a space occasionally. It flashes like butterflies.
Well, absolutely. I've noticed that. So you can take that advice from Jimmy and take a pause.
Sounds good to me. Here we go.
Welcome to the Mad in America podcast, your source for science, psychiatry, and social justice. Hello, this is James, and welcome to the Mad in America podcast.
And this week, Emily Shearer-Cutler interviews Dr. William Davies, author of The Happiness Industry.
So welcome to the Mad in America podcast. This week, we're going to be interviewing Dr. William Davies. He's a reader in political economy at Goldsmiths University of London, and he's the author of a renowned book called The Happiness Industry. His next book, Nervous States, Democracy, and the Decline of Reason, will be published by Norton in early 2019. So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Davies.
Pleasure.
Can you go ahead and define the happiness industry for our listeners?
Sure. I think there has been, I think many people will recognize a development of, on various fronts, both in the business world and in the health world, and in the public policy world and in the realm of self-help, a rising set of techniques and set of ideas that treat happiness as something that can be measured, something that can be monitored, managed, and ultimately can be optimized in ways that will make us healthier, more productive, more socially successful, more confident, and that happiness can become not just an ethical achievement, as it was for many philosophers over thousands of years, or something that happens to us, and that's where the word happiness originally comes from, is that it's something that kind of happened to us, it almost by accident, but that we can actively inculcate it and we can actively pursue it in the way that we might pursue other types of goods in the workplace or in the economy. So that's the kind of general topic of my analysis in the Happiness Industry book. But of course, you know, that varies from different cases to cases, and it has different types of history depending on what exactly you're talking about.
So what are some of the ways that the happiness industry is manifested in our culture, either through different self-help groups or psychiatry?
Well, I mean, one place to start would be in workplaces, because I think that there's quite a lot of evidence that people who are happier are also more engaged with their work and are more productive and might achieve more in their careers and so on. Now, this obviously poses various questions about the nature of the relationship between these different things, because obviously it may be that people are happier because they've been more lucky or more successful in the labor market or whatever it might be. But I think one thing that's changed, I think, especially since the 1990s, is that a new set of techniques has entered the management profession and the human resources profession, which has looked at trying to kind of bolster happiness of employees so as to make them more hardworking, less likely to take sick leave, less likely to kind of disengage from their work and that sort of thing. And these techniques can be anything from, I mean, you know, some of them are very good techniques. Some of them are things that we should welcome, such as just trying to make the workplace kind of, you know, a nicer place to be and allowing people to take breaks and these sorts of things that no one can complain about. But I think that where it becomes more insidious and some people are rather more suspicious is you hear of stories of workplaces where people take part in, you know, at the beginning of the day, there'll be kind of motivational speaking or singing or dancing even, so as to get people really kind of revved up, such that they have to kind of, you know, learn to really love their workplace, but almost in a kind of an enforced way. Or alternatively, there are workplaces where the employer doesn't necessarily really care that much about how the employee is feeling or how they, you know, how they really are inside, but they just want them to behave in a more kind of positive fashion. And I guess a case of this would be something like call centers, where frankly, it's quite high-stress work. There can be quite a high turnover of staff. But the main thing is that each person who is helped on the phone and, you know, each customer that rings up gets the feeling that they are at least being spoken to by someone who is positive and happy. But inside, that person might be miserable. And, I mean, one of the first case studies or first pieces of empirical research on this in the social sciences was a landmark book called The Managed Heart by a famous American sociologist called Arlie Russell Hochschild. And this was around about 1980. And she studied airline stewards to look at the ways in which they were sort of encouraged to smile and behave in a certain way so as to kind of exude a positivity. And that was really, I think, at the dawn of a new era of workplace practices where positivity and the kind of outward manifestations of positive affect were being kind of inculcated as part of a new set of techniques in the workplace. So those are just some examples in the workplace, but I mean, we could also talk about self-help, or we can talk about, you know, the way in which happiness has become part of the kind of, you know, doctor-patient relationship, or equally the way in which, you know, there is a whole kind of, I guess you could call it an industry of, well, as the way in which positive thinking has been kind of mobilized by various sort of gurus and self-help gurus as a way of trying to telling people they'll become rich if only they can start to think more positively about their life and that sort of thing.
So I want to go back to what you said about the 70s and 80s was kind of when this all started. And I know your book has talked a little bit about other major self-help programs in the 70s. I was wondering if you could say more about the influence of those.
I think that there has been, I mean, clearly the influence of the 1960s is very important in all of this. And a lot of the first efforts to, maybe not in, I mean, I'm not sure if I really talk about it in the workplace, but I think, I mean, there was a transformation in the way in which, in particular, in which depression was understood between the early 60s and the late 70s, where, I mean, this is a slightly separate issue, but I think it certainly has contributed to the sense that happiness and unhappiness are things that can be kind of scientifically and objectively known about and quantified, was clearly something that, you know, I think that the changes in the nature of psychiatric understanding of depression, this was a major issue over the 60s and 70s. And that there were various forces that fed into that. One was humanist psychology. And there has been there's some really interesting kind of histories of this as well, in terms of, you know, the idea that a human being really ought to carry on getting kind of happier and happier and happier, which is never something that kind of someone like Freud believed, for instance. But also the introduction of new scales for measuring depression, such as the Beck Depression Inventory, which was, I think, 1961. And then you get the kind of medicalization of American psychiatry that is a story that's been mapped in various ways, such that by the late 1970s, you know, to feel kind of unhappy for a certain length of time was something that could become measured using various scales and ultimately could become the basis of a diagnosis of a particular, you know, affective disorder in ways that sort of had lost a lot of the kind of psychoanalytic baggage that had previously gone with the understanding of depression up until that time. So there was definitely a kind of key set of shifts that went on between in the 60s and 70s that plays a role. I didn't really look at that in the context of management so much.
And then, yeah, what about kind of contemporary, how has that changed up until now and influenced how it's carried out today?
Well, I mean, just to step back for a moment, I mean, so in my book, I talk about the aspiration to get a kind of a scientific and quantitative knowledge of happiness as actually quite a foundational enlightenment dream, really, and you could even say a fantasy, and it begins with the work of the English philosopher Jeremy Bentham right back in the 1780s, who had these kind of, you know, he dreamt that one day we might be able to really kind of get an actual measure of happiness, and so we could compare, you know, how two different activities, which was better, purely in completely kind of scientific objective terms, and this kind of, this is a sort of dream that's been hovering in the background for a long time, but it always kind of seems to recur every time there's a major breakthrough in particular technological and scientific fields. And, you know, one of those moments, I look at a moment in the late 19th century where there was sort of whole new attention to, you know, the birth of psychology and the birth of neoclassical economics, which made people think they were going to kind of grasp this. But in terms of the present day, I think there are a couple of things that have really created a massive leap in this dream has been revived all over again. One is the rapid advances in the neurosciences over the last kind of 20 years or so, which have created a lot of excitement in areas such as market research and elsewhere, that we can really kind of get to grips with how pleasure and happiness and desire operate at a neurochemical level. And, you know, you sort of hear people talking about kind of dopamine as this sort of, you know, the reward chemical where people buy something, they get a shot of dopamine, and or they take some cocaine and they get a shot of dopamine, or, you know, someone makes a good trade on the stock market and they get this shot of dopamine. And this is, a very sort of crude sort of reduction of what is no doubt a much more complicated neuroscientific story. But there is, I think there's been a lot of... in some ways, kind of particularly the popularization of neuroscience has led to this, huge kind of enthusiasm for this version of how we make our decisions, how we make our choices. While at the same time, you know, there's a sort of, I think the neurochemical theory of depression has, you know, is as dominant as it's ever been. I mean, this, the idea that depression is a breakdown in neurochemistry, which was, you know, started to become the orthodoxy in the 1970s. But now I think, and this isn't, I'm not dismissing it as such, but I think it's, you know, in terms of the sort of development of how we understand ourselves and our happiness and our unhappiness, I think that it's now as dominant as it's ever been, that we understand depression as a breakdown in neurochemistry. So that's one thing that's going on, is that we think of our feelings as physical phenomena much more. We think of them as they are things that our body is doing, that our brain is doing. The other thing that is, you know, a constantly moving frontier, and it's moved, you know, even since I published my book 3 years ago, it's moved significantly, is how Silicon Valley gets to grips with all of this stuff. Obviously, the market research industry has, ever since the founding of market research in the late 19th century, has wanted to know kind of what gives people pleasure, what determines people's desires and choices and preferences and so on, for obvious reasons. And, you know, there is this whole field of what's called affective computing, which includes techniques for being able to calculate the feelings expressed in a given sentence, like in a tweet or something. Equally, facial analytics, being able to detect different moods on facial expressions, so that, you know, you feed a machine learning algorithm kind of like thousands or millions of different facial expressions with some way of being able to learn about what kind of mood these faces are conveying. These social media platforms like Snapchat and others are patenting all sorts of different techniques for being able to extract some kind of intelligence from the faces that are being shared on their platforms. And this can be done in public as well now. I mean, it sounds rather sort of terrifying to think, but, you know, it is possible now for an advertising hoarding to show you a different image depending on what kind of mood your face is expressing. So this can be done, and it raises civil liberties questions, but these techniques are now out there. So I think that the sense of emotion as something that belongs to the body in some way is expressed by the face, the body, pulse rates, other types of sort of vital signs of the body, and can be read by an algorithm. I think this is becoming the sort of new hegemony of sort of how happiness is kind of grasped sort of technically and scientifically. Now, of course, you know, human beings are more complicated than that, and hopefully we all know we're more complicated than that, and there will be aspects of ourselves that don't get grasped that way. But I think that is the frontier of where a lot of the science is going.
Well, we're listening there to Dr. Will Davies, who has written a book about the happiness industry. It's called The Happiness Industry. That was first broadcast as a podcast by Mad in America. So we're going to take a music break, and we'll hopefully get back to Will Davies after the break.
I promised you I'd give you Joe Cocker last week, so, well, how can you argue with that if I can get it playing? Here we go. This is from the movie An Officer and a Gentleman. It's Joe Cocker and Jennifer Warnes, Up Where We Belong.
Who knows what tomorrow brings? In a world few hearts survive.
All I know is the way I feel. Really, I keep it alive. is long. There are mountains in our way, but we climb and stare every day.
Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
And what do you think is the impact of that on our culture? How does that play out in societies and social life and the workplace?
Well, I mean, the sense of depression in particular as neurochemical, but equally sort of positive affect as neurochemical. I mean, of course, some people have been hugely helped by that as a kind of discovery of the last 40 or 50 years, and there are lots of people out there who would say that they wouldn't be alive right now if it wasn't for SSRIs, and we have to kind of respect that and take that very seriously, and not sort of claim that that's sort of ideological or something. But I think that there is a sort of, in some ways, it's the entire notion of the modern self, as to put it in philosophical terms, if we think of modern societies. In the sort of, I suppose, back in the 17th century, developed an idea of all of us having this kind of autonomous liberal subjectivity within us, which has gradually been kind of eroded by various forces, which show that we're actually kind of, you know, we don't really take decisions, our brains do before we even become conscious of them, or whatever it might be. And equally, you know, it's possible that a wearable technology can sort of tell you, you know, where you are happiest, or, you know, what behaviors are kind of, can spot various correlations between your location and your mood, or your behavior and your mood, and so on. So I think that, I mean, I'm not saying that we live in a culture where people are just sort of trusting their apps and trusting their data to decide how to live their lives. But I think that a lot of this potentially, you know, turns happiness into another type of sort of health, or another type of economic productivity, where it is possible to sort of minutely manage both our own lives according to a sort of form of mood optimization. But I think that in particular, retail environments and workplace environments can be far more scientifically carefully designed around what kinds of moods and affect, or cities for that matter. You know, like it's possible to think about what kind of, you know, how would you design a city or design a, some of these sort of campus type workplaces. Tony Hsieh, who's the founder of Zappos.com, I mean, I think he's a great believer in these sort of new kind of campus-like workplace models where kind of the entire employee has all of their sort of needs and some emotional, physical, and psychological needs all sort of taken care of by this environment, which raises the question of sort of how do we kind of leave anything to chance any longer? How do we sort of mess up or have accidents or discover new things that we had no idea we were into, or also kind of endure the sort of suffering that sometimes goes with great experiences or difficult experiences and that sort of thing. And I mean, I don't want to romanticize some sort of kind of pre-industrial or kind of anti-industrial happiness. And I think it's important to recognize, you know, that there's nothing kind of intrinsically kind of creative or productive about misery. I mean, I think we have to sort of not fall into that kind of romantic trap either, which can be sort of rather conservative and oppressive. But I do think that the infiltration into our minds and moods by combination of increasing transparency of brain activity and increasing monitoring of communication and increasing intelligence of computers in this area, the whole field of affective AI or whatever term you use for it, it means that less and less of these domains of human experience and relationships are kind of opaque in a way. I mean, the mystery of a lot of these areas of our lives is being sort of corroded in some ways, and I think that is sad.
Absolutely. Yeah, going back to what you said about romanticizing misery, I've definitely heard that notion, and I'm not sure that the idea of romanticizing misery is that far off from what the happiness industry is, because I think that, yeah, on the one hand, you have pre-industrial notions of, romanticized misery or almost like anti-happiness, and then you have the happiness industry, which isn't really doing anything necessarily to increase conditions that will make somebody happy, but basically saying it's okay if these conditions are still there that make you miserable. You can control your own happiness. You can take that into your own hands. Do you think that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the risk. I mean, I think there are various ways in which you can try and collect knowledge about happiness, and they produce different they have different sort of political implications or ethical implications. So if the focus is always on the individual and their behavior and their brain and their face and their, you know, activity, then that is on the one hand quite disempowering for that individual, because it kind of, you know, who's going to collect that data and what are they going to do with it? And this is a rather dystopian society. On the other hand, it can potentially be used simply to make them feel more guilty and more responsible if they're made to feel that they, you know, everything is within their control when clearly it's not. I mean, I don't think it's unique to Britain, but it's one of the sort of more concerning stories that I came across when I was researching the book is we have state provided unemployment benefits in the UK, but they've become less and less generous over time and increasingly contingent on the fact that the recipients have to be looking for work. And this is part of a sort of workfare system that was pioneered in the United States and has been kind of mimicked in some ways in Britain. But increasingly, what I discovered when I was looking into this is that these workfare programs, which are about trying to get people to sort of go and find work, we're integrating positive thinking programs so that people would be forced to recite these various slogans like, you know, the only person who's holding me back is myself, and, you know, there's no fault in falling down, but you have to keep on getting up again, and, like, you know, like, no one ever drowned in their own sweat, and these sort of, you know, positive thinking slogans, and they'd be forced to do it when they might be facing terrible obstacles elsewhere in their lives. Like, you know, they might have, you know, like loads of children they need caring for, they might have disabilities, they might be anxious about their housing situation, they might have all sorts of, they might be, you know, caring for elderly relatives. Like, and this, like, the fact that you have to kind of recite what is plainly a lie, that, you know, I'm the only person who can stop and who can hold myself back, is kind of like horrendous, really, that the state would force people to sort of kind of state untruths in that way. And I think what was even more concerning about some of that, and this has really got some of the psychotherapy profession very, very worried in Britain and quite angry, actually, was that in certain cases they would actually be required to engage with cognitive behavioral therapy as a condition of receiving their benefits. So that effectively they're saying, look, you're depressed because you're unemployed, and you are going to have to go through 8 weeks of cognitive behavioral therapy in order to carry on with this program. So effectively you've got a kind of state enforced cognitive behavioral therapy program. I mean, a lot of therapists were saying, you know, the precedents for states using psychotherapeutic techniques in this way are horrific. I mean, we're looking at sort of, you know, this is sort of thing that would go on in the Soviet Union or something, in some of the worst instances of sort of, you know, re-education or something. So that is there's something quite politically frightening about this sort of turn towards individual attitude and behavior. On the other hand, a version of happiness science that was attentive to inequality, to institutions, to the things that, you know, schools can do. Schools can have a huge impact on children's well-being in terms of, you know, the extent to which they allow them to just sort of play and sort of learn in a relaxed environment and so on, and that has a huge effect on their happiness and their well-being and so on. Or, you know, there are aspects to do with public health and social security in general. I mean, not just in sort of particular welfare areas, but clearly a lot of unhappiness could be alleviated with reduced economic and social insecurity, and a lot of anxiety stems from people's circumstances. So you could imagine a sort of politically progressive version of all of this.
I wanted to go back to, you were talking about how CBT and how these like positive thinking slogans are being forced on people. So typically when we think about forced treatment, and so far what this podcast has covered, this podcast series, is we think about forced psychiatric treatment, forced drugging, maybe incarceration. We don't think about positive thinking necessarily or CBT. So could you speak more directly to the coercive aspects of the happiness industry and how it can be seen as a form of forced treatment?
Well, I mean, I think workplaces are one area where I think if people are required to engage in kind of positive thinking programs in workplaces, then that has a potentially a coercive aspect to it. I mean, I mentioned, you know, CBT being integrated into the welfare state in Britain, which, I mean, it's pretty marginal to be honest, that is. But I think, I don't know. I mean, do you know of cases of CBT being forced upon people?
I mean, definitely in psychiatric hospitals where people are required to undergo CBT, and I've also heard about that, the welfare program. Yeah, but I also think maybe that the principles of CBT have kind of permeated into everyday life. I don't know if you've seen that at all.
Yeah, I mean, CBT obviously, and again, I mean, we have to acknowledge that these things often have good intentions and they can achieve positive outcomes. So they're not wholly, I think it's always worth recognizing that, just, you know, for any listeners who've had good experiences, they're not trying to say that they're fake or something like that. But in Britain, a lot of this was developed by an economist who was close to the Blair government, called Richard Layard. And he's a very esteemed professor of economics at the London School of Economics. And he developed a sort of economic business case, really, it was called a business case for CBT, where he sort of put together the economic analysis showing that, you know, people, that if people could get 8 weeks of CBT, this would actually be a net positive to the economy because of the cost that depression and absence from work and the cost to the welfare state of people suffering from mental health disorders of various kinds. And this was pretty groundbreaking in the early 2000s, and this developed into a program in our National Health Service called IAPT, which stands for Increasing Access to Psychological Therapies. And this meant that effectively, because long-term psychotherapy is not really compatible with an economic mentality, because you don't know how long it's going to go on for, you don't know what the results are going to be. I mean, there is an effort in certain corners of psychodynamic psychotherapy to start building a business, start building an evidence base for its effects. And I think some people are showing that you can construct actually quite a convincing evidence base, because the relapse rates are far lower than under CBT of long-term psychodynamic psychotherapy or psychoanalysis. But I think part of Layard's achievement in Britain anyway was to get doctors to start prescribing CBT much more widely, and to get the NHS to offer it. But it also means that CBT has now become a sort of, a bit like, I think, you know, Prozac ended up being used for all sorts of different problems. It became a sort of, you know, something which was a sort of seen as being something you could sort of throw Prozac at things and see how it turned out. CBT has become a bit like that as well, so that, you know, if you're sort of, I don't know, nervous of public speaking or something, or nervous about flying or something like that, you can turn that into a diagnosis and then prescribe CBT for it. And this becomes, yes, I think as you say, it becomes a sort of a way of thinking about problems that by thinking about them simultaneously, cognitively and behaviorally, that you can kind of learn to manage them in different ways. And it's not, I mean, I've never had CBT myself, but as I understand it, I mean, it's not a million miles away from other forms of, it might be more scientifically grounded in some ways, but I mean, there are other forms of positive thinking and which might be more kind of guru-led, and some which are plainly sort of based in kind of sort of a fair amount of kind of fantasies and so on. And but there's a kind of a spectrum, I think, of scientific credibility, and you know, there are other positive thinking kind of mantras and belief systems and so on that CBT is not a million miles away from. Right. So it's sort of, I suppose it's problematic in a way when it, you know, when it becomes seen as being a sort of something that has some sort of, you know, that it can sort of deliver outcomes or solve problems, when human beings aren't really like that a lot of the time.
And we're just going to take a music break now. I've got Mandy from Barry Manilow. You're listening to Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, broadcasting here every single Tuesday from 12:30 to 1:30 on Planet FM 104.6. Here's Mandy from Barry Manilow.
As cold as ice, shadows of a man, a face through a window, crying in the night. The night goes into morning, just another day. Happy people pass my way. Looking in their eyes, I see a memory I never realize how happy you made me. Oh, Mandy, well, you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away. Oh, Mandy, you kissed me and stopped me from shaking, and I need you today. Standing on the edge of time, I've walked away when love was mine. I was caught up in a world of uphill climbing. The tears are in my mind and nothing is rhyming. Oh, Mandy, well, you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away. Kiss
yesterday's a dream. Now I face the morning, crying on a breeze. The pain is calling, oh Mandy. Well, you came and you gave without taking, but I sent you away, oh Mandy. You kissed me and stopped me from shaking. And I need you.
You're with Take It From Us on 104.6 Planet FM.
Yeah, and I'm host Sheldon Brown, and we're listening to a podcast today from Mad in America Radio. It's an interview with Will Davies, a fairly academic treatise on happiness. He's the author of a book called The Happiness Industry. So let's go back to that for the last part of our show.
And going back to some of the wealth programs that you mentioned in the workplace, could you tell us a little bit more about the coercive aspects of those and how those are mandated?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, in some ways this goes together with the increase of surveillance in workplaces, which a lot of people are quite anxious about at the moment. I mean, the capacity for surveillance of employee wellness and behavior is just shooting up massively at the moment. And I mean, this is partly, I mean, you hear of what's sometimes called Taylorism 2.0, because Frederick Taylor, who's someone I talk a bit about in the book, but was often called the world's first management consultant, operating in Philadelphia in the kind of 1890s, and would basically just sort of measure people's movement and then look at all of the data and in workplaces, in factories, look at all the data and then say, well, if we did it like this, then you'd save this much time and therefore you'd save this much money, basically. And nowadays, of course, Amazon can apply a very similar mentality to the way in which their warehouses are run, but they don't have to kind of have a management consultant standing there with a clipboard. They just attach kind of devices to everybody's bodies so as to see kind of, you know, are people moving efficiently and how long is their bathroom break, and you know, are they kind of moving around the shelf stacks in the most efficient way. And that's a fairly frightening kind of vision. It doesn't necessarily engage with their wellness, but there are all these kind of suites of technologies which can also potentially include, you know, looking at, you can run sentiment analysis programs on people's emails to see if they are expressing kind of any form of unhappiness in by their work email. You know, you might have a workplace counseling service or a workplace nutritional service so as to try and help people live happier, more healthy lives and so on. And obviously there's a balance between, you know, if someone is told you have to wear this wearable or you're going to get fired, that is clearly a kind of coercive situation. Whereas you might have a much more sort of, you know, like the kind of Google campus model where you've got kind of, you know, really quite privileged employees, but ultimately kind of their workplace is trying to cater to all of their needs. So almost so they never need to leave, really. You know, that you might get, you might have workplace meditation sessions and mindfulness. And I mean, I haven't even mentioned mindfulness, but of course that's a key part of the way in which sort of happiness is being brought into workplaces, schools. It's particularly popular in Silicon Valley. And, you know, a sort of an idea that and it goes, I think, heavily along with a kind of neuroscientific idea of what happiness is, because in a way, I think a lot of, and the other thing I haven't mentioned yet, is the discovery of sleep as this sort of thing that can be optimized. And Arianna Huffington's kind of latest venture, I understand, is based around trying to promote more optimal sleep in various ways. And so, you know, this idea that a human being is a kind of an asset that can be optimized in mind and body, and can equally break down in mind and body, has a sort of, maybe not, I mean, I wouldn't myself choose to call it coercive, because that suggests that you kind of don't have any choice, but it has certainly has a sort of a rather kind of, it has a surveillance aspect, and it has a kind of, you know, a sort of all-encompassing, rather totalizing aspect, you know, that it's a sort of doesn't really offer much of an outside or the capacity to sort of ever evade the gaze of the mood monitor or the behavioral monitor and that sort of thing. So it sort of operates less coercively in the sense of kind of forcing people to do things, and more, and this is where I suppose my work is influenced by the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault, who believed that actually, you know, often power doesn't act to repress us, but it kind of acts almost sort of through our own volition in some ways, that it's, you know, rather than sort of the vision of a sort of the sort of George Orwell's vision of power as kind of snooping on us and frightening us. Actually, in some ways, it's, you know, the ways in which we are sort of encouraged to try and be more sort of free or happy or be more ourselves is itself a sort of rather imprisoning one in its own right.
Yes, absolutely. I think coercion is a spectrum too. I think, yeah, there's definitely more like enforced, there's forced drugging and there's involuntary commitment. But I completely agree with you and Foucault, who have said that force is also, or power is also carried out through more subtle mechanisms. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you can speak to the role that both the happiness industry and that kind of surveillance play in neoliberalism and capitalism. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, a lot of what I've been talking about already is, I suppose, implicitly in the context of neoliberal capitalism. Right. I think neoliberalism is a system, and in my first book was called The Limits of Neoliberalism, and it was about, I suppose, the ideology of neoliberalism. And I placed particular emphasis on, in my understanding of neoliberalism in that book, I argue that neoliberalism is an ideology that tries to organize all domains of social life, not just markets, but around the logic of competition and competitiveness. So that it's not just enough to say you have to be, you know, in a market competition, for instance, in a labor market. You know, we reorganize universities around rankings and constantly sort of trying to rise up rankings. Or we organize, if you want to modernize your health system, you have to kind of make it more competitive. You have examples of people who have been kind of big sports coaches going and becoming management gurus or vice versa. So you've got this sort of mentality that everything has to be reorganized so that people are in a condition of rivalry against each other. And that's the sort of way to improve performance, is to constantly try and reorganize things in that way. That's my sort of understanding of neoliberalism. Right. I think in terms of where happiness comes into that is in a couple of ways, really. One is that the question of motivation becomes very, very crucial in that kind of culture and that kind of political society, because in a sense the neoliberal injunction, and I think in some ways you could say this is in some ways a core pathology of American society, so maybe it goes back much longer in American culture. But I suppose someone like Milton Friedman, who was one of the great neoliberal ideologues, was sort of in some ways trying to sort of resuscitate the American ideal. But you have to constantly believe that you can make it in this neoliberal system. You can't sort of say, well, I want to be mediocre. You have to, because if you're going to be mediocre, someone's going to come along and beat you, and they might take what you have. You know that you're in a race the entire time. So the question of how you keep on believing and aspiring and desiring is a constant sort of kind of challenge to the neoliberal ego, to the neoliberal self, is that you have to kind of find within yourself the resources to believe that you can be the best and that you can be you can be better than others. And that's where I think the kind of culture of self-help, positive thinking plays such an important role economically, because the mentality of neoliberalism is to say, you know, like, if you're poor, that's sort of your fault in some way. And it's because you have sort of, you have not shown yourself to be kind of competitive enough, to be worthy enough. The neoliberal critique of of the welfare state is that it just inculcates laziness, and they need to be cut back, because then people will find the resources to sort of throw themselves forward into some kind of sort of enterprising entrepreneurial activity. But this places this huge strain on the self, and particularly on the, you know, like, it's fine when you've been born into money or something. I think a lot of neoliberalism kind of breaks down eventually over things like inherited wealth, because ultimately, you know, it's easy to take risks when you've got something to fall back on. It's very hard to take risks and be that kind of enterprising self when you've got nothing to fall back on. And if failing means that you're going to be kind of living in the street, then kind of believing in that sort of ideal of constant competition and competitiveness is very, very hard. And so that, I think, so in a sense, it instrumentalizes positive thinking. I think what the other thing it does is that it, you know, in a sense, and one of the best books I've ever read on depression is a book called The Weariness of the Self by Alan Ehrenberg. And Ehrenberg kind of sees contemporary depression as a distinctively neoliberal condition, really, of the depressed self. I mean, until the 1960s or 70s, depression was conceived of as some sort of form of guilt or shame. And this is how Freud understood it, or he called it melancholia, which was that the self sort of had a desire that was being repressed. So it might be that you wanted to be one thing, but society was telling you to be another. So you might be homosexual, but you didn't feel able to express that desire because of social norms or something. So there was a kind of a conflict and a feeling of guilt and shame and neurosis. But what Ehrenberg shows is that from the sort of 60s onwards, and then neoliberalism sort of, I suppose, kind of channels this into the economy, the injunction is to just be more and more and more and do achieve more and more and more and desire more and more and demand more and more and achieve more and compete more. And the depression is a sort of becomes a disorder of just sort of collapse, really, that I just can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. Like I haven't got anything more in the tank, you know. And so I think that, you know, the way in which these sort of these mental sort of you know, these syndromes and diagnoses change. And I think that neoliberal capitalism is a crucial context to all of this. I mean, in terms of capitalism more generally, I mean, there was, you know, a sort of rapid deindustrialization across the Western economies that, well, it was underway from the 50s, but it accelerated rapidly in the 70s and 80s, such that economies became more organized around the production of intangible services, customer service, creativity, you know, that what a worker was increasingly a sort of, you know, you had to channel the emotional and psychological aspects of your workforce. And this is why Hochschild's study in The Managed Heart around 1980 was such a kind of interesting and important time to do that, was that this was the development of what some sociologists would call post-Fordism, where you've moved out of a Fordist economy, producing kind of cars in a production line, and no one really cares how you're feeling as you do it, to this post-Fordist economy, where you might be making coffee or developing, you know, I don't know, animations in a studio or a graphic designer or on a call center or something, where the spirit with which you do it and the look on your face as you do it and your feelings of enthusiasm about it matter deeply to your employer. So there's a kind of like a sort of mobilization of the psyche and of affect from the 1970s onwards.
Mm-hmm. I did want to ask also about the U.S. recovery movement, and I think it's also in the U.K. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I'm not, actually.
Okay, sort of the consumer, survivor, ex-patient, kind of people with lived experience of mental health challenges or trauma, distress, people basically advocating recovery through alternative means to the psychiatric system. So sometimes that's psychotherapy, but other times that is more positive thinking. And then there's also obviously the addiction field version of recovery, and that's more 12-step programs and things like that. Has your work touched on that at all either?
Not really, actually. I mean, it sounds very interesting. I mean, I know that, you know, there are various efforts to try and come up with alternative ways of relieving distress in these various ways. And I know there's been sort of over time, there's been sort of community mental health programs and you know, there's, I mean, I've heard of this sort of thing. I mean, there's an interesting example in the UK which has been studied a bit as a kind of alternative sort of non medicinal approach to mental health. And there's one example called the Talk Hearing Voices Network, which includes people who hear voices, so they could be diagnosed as schizophrenic, but at the same time their diagnosis doesn't really help them very much and the treatments don't kind of make these voices go away, and so instead they have turned it into a kind of form of identity, and that they share their experiences, and you know, and they have very positive experiences as well. Lots of them quite like their voices, or they have different names for them, and they've integrated them into their lives in various ways. So I think that a sort of demedicalization of mental experiences and of distress, I think, obviously has quite a lot of sort of political potential.
Yeah, I think so. I also do worry, though, at times I see it going in the direction of more positive thinking. And yeah, I'm not sure if you've seen anything like that. There is a group specifically in the UK that's kind of critiquing that called Recovery in the Bin. That's looking at how recovery is used to kind of enforce these neoliberal policies. Yeah, so I think that's all the questions I have. Is there anything else you'd want to share?
So my next book is called Nervous States, Democracy and Decline of Reason. And it's, I suppose it's about nervous states in multiple senses. I mean, one is that I think there's a kind of pun that, I mean, we live in a politically nervous situation where we don't really, we feel that we're on the cusp of some fairly major developments at the moment, and people read the news kind of not knowing what to expect from one day to the next. But I think it's also, I suppose, nervous in a sort of, almost in a kind of cybernetic sense, that we live increasingly in a state of reactivity and living in a kind of flow of real-time data, which is making us increasingly jumpy the entire time, where we are, and it's, I think it's also damaging our democracy, and it's damaging our capacity to have more careful, slower types of dialogue at a public level, because we're constantly living in this world at the moment where we've got a tweeting president of the United States who is able to kind of completely change the mood or the discussion that people are having from one moment to the next simply by using his Twitter feed. And so the book is really about sort of some of the kind of challenges that this type of real-time reactivity that some of how it affects us both personally but also politically, and I think that I suppose there's been a lot of discussion of this idea of post-truth with the rise of Trump and populism in Europe and so on, and although I don't really use that term, the book is partly trying to understand what is going on with the status of expertise and facts in society, but by trying to say, well, it's partly about an over-acceleration of public discourse that is being affected partly by the rise.
Well, that's Dr. Will Davies is a reader in political economy at Goldsmiths University of London. I'm afraid a fairly academic sort of treatise on happiness, but that came from the podcast from Mad in America Radio. So the AGM of Changing Minds, the consumer network, is coming up on Monday, the 3rd of December at 6 p.m. The venue is yet to be confirmed, but I think if you go on the Changing Minds website, you will find out. There'll be an update from the Changing Minds chief executive, Tammy Allen, and also an update from the Board of Trustees, Kerry Hannafin, and there'll be a bit of an outline on Rākau Roroa, New Zealand's first mental health champions program. So, keep an eye on that this coming Monday, 6 p.m. That's the 3rd of December. And we've been looking at some of the alternatives to medication, and certainly Mad in America is always advocating alternatives to medication. And some that are listed here are things like acupuncture, affirmations, arts and crafts, creativity, reading books, and going to Hearing Voices groups. And the Hearing Voices Network was mentioned in our interview with Will Davies, attending clubs such as a laughter club, doing exercises, many types of exercises which can be helpful, gardening is listed here, and other things. So lots of alternatives to taking medication. Well, here's Joe Cocker to finish Take It From Us today.
That's us. Catch you next week.
How in the world do you think anybody's supposed to respect?